So mark it on your calendar, December 9th. That is the day that railroad workers in the Conductors Union, or what's known as, I think it's Smart TD is the name of the union, could go on strike after they rejected a contract that was accepted and ratified by 11 out of the 12 major rail unions. They are the lone holdouts, rejecting it today by just 0.8%. But it's enough that it puts the economy in deep jeopardy, because without conductors, you're going to see the nation's rail system grind to a halt. $2 billion in economic output would be lost per day if that strike should happen. Under the National Railway Act, Congress has the power to intervene and impose a settlement on the two sides to shorten a work stoppage. That's what they did 30 years ago in 1991. After a 24-hour rail strike, ordering them back to their jobs after they passed, and then President H.W. Bush signed the legislation. Should they do it again, if it should come to that? Brent is in Waterford with some thoughts on that. Hey, Brent.
Well, your previous caller kind of stole my thunder. I had a Marine that worked for me who is a mechanic for one of those four unions, mm-hmm. and I've talked to him, and it's absolutely, it's not money, it's quality of life. Very similar, you know, like I'm very aware of the medical community right now. Beaumont's a perfect example. When the nurses there were trying to organize, it wasn't about money, it was about quality of life. I have too many days off, I get fired. If I, you know, I get sick, I have to come in sick or get fired. And, okay, talking about the Congress, I believe that was, or still is, for a couple more months, Representative Levin's district. And while the nurses were trying to organize, and you had the hospital spending millions on union busting, not a peep out of Levin. He was down in Alabama grandstanding with the Amazon organizing effort. And I like to think that's one of the reasons he's not going to be a representative anymore.
Very good point, Brent. Yeah, it certainly doesn't sound like this is a bunch of snowflake whining about work-life balance. When you talk to some of these folks about the level of burnout that they have, I appreciate the call. Let's quickly go to John in Chesterfield, and then we've got to move on to another topic. Hey, John.
All right. President Harry Truman, he put the railroad people in place. He says, if you guys don't go back to work when they threaten to shut down, he says, I'll draft you in the service. Former President Reagan did the same thing with the air traffic controllers. You guys don't want to go to work, and replace them with the National Guard and fire them all. They got to go to work. You don't shut the economy down. All right, that's all I got. Thank you.
Yeah, and listen, you can play hardball with these guys, and I guess that's why they called him Give Them Hell Harry, right? But you got to know that these are essential workers, and that perhaps a more mindful way of approaching this might be the best thing, especially when you hear the testimonials of the guys that we've heard from just over the last couple of minutes here. What could be a major setback? We knew this was going to be a groundbreaking case. Talking about the case, an accountability case against James and Jennifer Crumbly, the mother and father of Ethan Crumbly, who's already admitted to shooting and killing four students at Oxford High School. The Oakland County prosecutor on a quest to hold them accountable for their son's murderous rampage. Well, now that quest may be even more daunting than it previously was, as a judge is rejecting a legal theory that those prosecutors had hoped to use against the parents. So how much does that help the defense and harm the prosecution? We turn to a gentleman who always gives us good insight on these matters, some that has been at both tables in criminal court, Todd Flood, who is the principal at Flood Law. Hi, Todd.
Hey, good afternoon, Guy. How are you?
Good, sir. So just help us understand what this legal theory is. It's called the pathway to violence theory. In layman's terms, what is it?
Well, it is a tendency to show this basic inertia of acts and putting the parents on trial for their misgivings and how they basically neglected their son and ultimately gave all the tools necessary, unfortunately so, or whatever they want to, however they want to call it, to predict the future of saying, hey, he was guaranteed to do A, B, C, and D. But unfortunately, that's all junk science. And you and I spoke about this once before when the prosecution wanted to put this in and they made their motion. There's no reliability to it. It would never pass what we call a Ginther hearing, where the experts are using science and standards that are measurable and are tested and have been through the rigors of a courtroom. So I don't think it's a, you know, it was a creative thought by the prosecution to bring this in. But as we predicted, it wouldn't come in. And Judge Matthews said as much, because it can't pass the standards for getting in evidence that shows something of tendency or the like for the parents to show culpability.
Right. Well, they couldn't prove a cause and effect relationship, right? So that made it unreliable and irrelevant, according to the judge. So what does that leave the prosecution? How much does that harm them?
Guy, the facts and the evidence of this case are going to be based on this. Did the parents leave a gun knowing their son had a propensity to do dangerous things? Did they leave that gun unprotected, unlocked, and having the knowledge, the notice that their son was disturbed? If you give the keys to your son to the car, and you know he can't drive, but yet you allow him to do so, you're going to be at peril because you are endangering others. So the same thing here with the gun. I think if the evidence and the facts come out, which I suspect they will, based on everything we've seen at the preliminary exams, based on the testimony that was given in front of the judge at the preliminary exams for the parents, I believe you will see that the parents had knowledge, one, that the son had propensities, that they, two, didn't have the firearm properly protected, three, that they basically had this indifference, this gross negligence, this willful indifference to safety of others. And I think if you get those facts, it's going to be hard for the defense to overcome.
And that's what it was always going to come down to, right? I mean, in the eyes of a judge or a jury, the expectation of what a reasonable and responsible parent would do.
That's right. That's right. And we have a case in the state of Michigan that fits on all fours, and it's an arson case where the parents were forewarned, the mom was forewarned many, many times about making sure that she kept incendiary devices or devices away from a child that constantly was lighting things on fire. And the mother fell asleep. The mother did not put matches away properly. The child lit an apartment curtain on fire, and another child died in the room down below. The Court of Appeals upheld the involuntary manslaughter on the mom, because she did not take due care and diligence as it relates to it. It was reasonably foreseeable that something bad would happen, and you had the cause and effect, the but-for and the proximate cause to show that, you know. So I see if the facts and evidence come out similar to that, just like that, on all fours, I think the Crumbleys are going to have a hard time overcoming that.
So us lay observers should remain the reasonably foreseeable standard is what they're going to be held to, and not some, don't want to call it a cockamamie theory, but an untested theory that it still comes back to what it was precedent setting in the first place in this arson case. Todd, thank you so much, and we always appreciate the clarification.
Guy, thanks for having me on. Always love being with you. Thanks.
All right, Todd Flood. When we come back, the Lions, 3 in a row. Dare we mention I can't say it yet, but we can hope it, can't we? Steve Courtney, next on The Guy Gordon Show.